Hey, everybody. My name's Jim Walker. I'm joined today by my best friend, Derek Cotton.
Hey, what's going on, y'all?
And this is the inaugural episode of the Everything is a Spring podcast, where we're just going to talk about basically whatever we want, and we're going to tie it back into engineering concepts and lots of spring puns.
It got to have some bounce in there, right? Because everything is a spring. I don't know much about engineering because my name is Derek Cotton. I am a Bachelor of Science in Biology, currently working in the data world for a healthcare company. So the idea, right, our general like concept and frame of reference is Jim, a mechanical engineer, really smart guy, one of my best friends of all time. He's going to explain a concept to me in engineering or some kind of, we're not going to put ourselves in a box, right? We could talk about anything.
Absolutely. We're going to be a very broad reach podcast because, you know, one of the big things about this podcast is it's an opportunity for Derek and I to just to hang out. And yeah. I think
that's the selfish reason.
Exactly. 100%. And I think in today's world, you know, where there's this, you know, epidemic of isolation where, you know, the technology that was supposed to bring us all together has actually driven us so far apart. And you know, we're going to co-opt that technology to spend time together, and we're going to try to make it work. And hopefully, you know, a gentle listener, you can kind of tune in and maybe, get some value out of this as well, where you kind of feel like you're part of the conversation as well. And, exactly. Encourage you to do this, connect with the people that you love. So.
Right, because you have all these podcasts out there, and each to their own, right? But we need to put some good vibes out into the world. I mean, I hate to use that term, but there's enough negativity, and of course, sometimes we'll have to talk about the goings-on. But this is an opportunity for you to join a couple friends on a journey of knowledge, learning about harmonic oscillation, because everything is a spring, and that's
everything.
I guess it makes sense for us to kind of go into how we came up with, why are we doing this? You know, like, what's the point?
Absolutely. So Derek and I, oh my gosh, how long has it been since we've seen each other?
Maybe a week and a half.
Before the vortex,
Oh, sheesh. Easily a year. Pushing on 8 to 10 months at least.
Yeah. It's just been a year of just tough stuff and tough decisions that had to be made and busy schedules. So it's been a long time. And this has kind of been, I guess, growing up, right? This is part of adulthood, and it kind of sucks.
Yeah, that's the part they don't tell you, right? You finally get all the money. You finally get the career. Like, you start getting on the right path towards that. Oh, I can actually afford things and, like, go enjoy life. And then you get smacked in the face with all these responsibilities. And it turns out sometimes you have to be the adult in a room of other adults, and that's never fun. So,
nope.
You know, it's it's a learning experience, and I kind of wanted to talk a little bit about, like, background, right? Because, Jim, you have a lot to talk about. You're a smart guy. It's really easy to forget, like, all the things you've accomplished, right? But I got to remember.
It's fair.
You know, like, no one thinks about the journey until after you're, like, done it, right?
Right.
It's hard to personify it in time, but like, I graduated with a degree in biology in 2020. Pause for like applause. Like, Jesus, it was the weirdest like situation to like the weirdest way to jump into the workforce I've ever seen, you know?
Oh my gosh. Yeah. So I just for reference, for our gentle listener, I graduated in December of 2019. So I started my job, and then the COVID-19 pandemic hit immediately. Right. And so it was just, I was fortunate enough that I was able to continue to do my job. And I was actually working at that point in time, as part of a makerspace. So I got to be a part of the, kind of the effort to, alleviate some of the difficulties that pandemic was placing on our supplies of masks and, face shields and this kind of stuff. So, we fired up like all the 3D printers that we had access to try to help supply our local area hospitals with masks and face shields. So that was amazing to be a part of. But it was this really weird, like, you know, I got a job and then nobody's in the office. Like, literally, I started maybe a week before the pandemic broke, right? So because I was like, everyone was starting to go off. I live in a college town. I live in Statesboro. So, you know, everybody went off for spring break and then nobody came back.
It was a weird time, man. Like, to put, like, I guess, chronological reference. So I was a year or two younger than Jim, right? So I'm on my senior year of college, finally starting to get that, oh, this is who I am as a person. You know, I've made my friends that are going to be with me, like, outside of college, past it, right? And it got weird. Like you said, that spring, that March area, you know, it went from, oh, I'm doing my undergraduate research to I'm the only person on campus in the biology department breaking down all of our labs because everyone's gone. And yeah, it was really surreal to actually be able to talk to my professors, right? Like these guys that have done virology, genetics, like all of these professionals, SMEs in their field come to teach, really actually panic. Like seeing your teachers worry for the first time was very surreal to me. But, you know, to make a long story short, I forced my roommate in college to help us do good protocol, make sure we weren't putting our families in danger. So we decided to stay down at college until, you know, we figured out what was going on. And it was a lot of just watching, you know, my classmates and stuff go continue to have fun, you know, have pool parties and stuff and just be like, hey, like, I know it's not fun. I know it's not like what you want to do, but we got to do what's best to like. We don't know how serious this is, but on a brighter note, all of that just kind of attributed to our growth, right? Like, it's odd to think about life after all that compressed stress, right?
Absolutely. One of the things, oh man, we could do a whole episode just on...
Is pandemic a spring?
I think you could look at the pandemic as a spring, and it really, I think, you know, in a more philosophical sense, you could look at culture as a spring, right? Culture is a spring. And I think part of this is like, what's the compression of the stress of COVID and then the elasticity of it bouncing back? But I listened to a podcast a while back and I can't remember the specifics of it. But it was basically talking about, you know, what's going to stay with us from the COVID pandemic? Like what's been normalized by the COVID pandemic?
You're right. Societal norms have changed.
They've changed significantly. I mean, and I think it's crazy, right? Because you've had basically, there were like 2 years where people just like didn't go talk to each other. Mm-mm. Most people, a lot of people. Well, in general, I think overall,
like worldwide,
the social contact between people was drastically reduced. And in some cases, yeah, almost completely eliminated. Part of this too is, you know, just like, what does that do to people? You know,
gosh, like what is isolation for, you know, I can say I'm introverted as much as I want, but we are a social species, right? Like
absolutely.
It's most mammals, but especially humans and like great apes. We need people, even if we like to pretend like we don't. And absolutely. I think folks got really used to loneliness for the first time. Like, don't get me wrong, I'm an only child, so like that's kind of like first position for us only children. You know, we have to learn how to be social, and then to kind of get back to your old ways, it's hard to bounce back. Like, I felt like I lost a lot of progress with all like the societal and social norms I was trying, like figuring out who I am as a person, back to, you know, just focusing on taking care of the family. You know, maybe we'd play a couple games in Discord every now and then, but besides that, not too much personal contact.
Absolutely. I mean, and like, you know, you missed weddings for this, you know?
And yeah,
like,
and that's a hard decision.
That sucks.
You know?
That's a really
I don't want
decision.
To put my family in danger. I don't want to put you in danger, because think about it. After college, I was working in a COVID lab, like almost pretty much that summer on. And that's something that weighed heavy on me, you know, like the risk versus reward of, I would love to go be a part of this special moment, but I don't want to be the reason like your grandpa gets sick, right? So that was a tough decision. Thankfully, things have kind of gotten a little bit better now. Like we have vaccines, you know, sorry folks, if you didn't realize, this is probably going to be a very scientific podcast as you're talking to an engineer and a biologist. So, you know, there's definitely some points where people have changed in ways we're not going to learn about until years later. Like the psychology and the sociology studies, I can't imagine what it's like to be in that field right now.
Oh, it's fascinating. We should definitely try to have somebody on who knows a little bit more about that than us.
Right? That'd be great. We can have guests.
That'd be great. We can absolutely have guests. So I don't know anybody who's in that field, but maybe we can
look
around. So
I can make a couple calls. But Jim, I guess this like kind of intro section, right? I was thinking, you know, we're a spring oriented and themed podcast, right?
Yes. What if we call it
the intro bit where we're just kind of talking? The preload.
The preload. Yes. The preload. I love it. The preload. Welcome to the preload.
Yeah, you know, this is us dickering around before we get on track, right?
I love it. I love it. Okay, well, in that case, because this has kind of been introductory, in that the listener has no idea who we are. And we've kind of tried to fill them in a little bit, and I think that process will take some time, and we don't want to load it too heavy on the front end. So let's get into the preload. So Derek, for our preload today, I have a question for you. What is your favorite type of candy?
My favorite type of candy. That is I have all the questions. Oh, I'm just going to go with like a Milky Way or like a Kit Kat. One of those two.
Milky Way or Kit Kat. So let's go more towards the Milky Way because it feeds better into my topic today. Nice. What's the center of a Milky Way made out of?
I think it's nougat, right?
Is it nougat?
It's like a nougat, caramel, like homogenous mixture of tasty.
What is the center of a Milky Way?
Yeah, we have the internet. We can use that.
No, not the galaxy.
The center of the Milky Way galaxy.
It's nougat. Yeah, so it's nougat topped with caramel and covered with milk chocolate.
Oh, yeah, so, I know my Milky Way.
That's excellent. So what is nougat, actually? I don't even know what that is.
You know, I have thought about this at night several times throughout history, and I don't know. I've just put it under the category of delicious and accepted nougat. That for what it is.
It is a candy made from sugar or honey, nuts, and egg white.
So it's like caramel, but spicy? Well, not spicy. Spicy in the non-flavor term, but it's a little zesty. It's got some kick to her.
I think the distinguishing factor is that it has nuts in it. So it's made with, it's basically, it's got like the roasted nuts, almonds, walnuts, pistachios, hazelnuts, etc. And then sometimes candied fruit. Okay. Huh, interesting.
Learning a lot about nougat today.
Anyway, nougat's not the point of our podcast today. What would you do? What would you do, Derek? To contain nearly 13,000 pounds, or excuse me, 13,000 tons of Milky Way.
13,000 tons?
How would you contain 13,000 tons of Milky Way?
Well, I'm guessing I can't eat that much. So that's plan A right out the door, right? Guess I would have to build some form of retaining wall or reservoir, something that's load-bearing. That can hold, I guess, the pressure of 13,000 tons of Milky Way.
Yes. So what I want you to imagine, right, is that at the scale of that, because that's going to be just an unimaginable amount of Milky Way bars.
It's like Lake Michigan of nougat.
It's going to act kind of like a fluid, right? So you do need that retaining wall to be able to hold back the tide of Milky Way. I want you to imagine for a moment, Derek.
All right. I'm imagining.
The retaining wall that you have built. For this enormous quantity of Milky Way bars, ruptures. The dam bursts asunder. And the Milky Way just flows out into the streets, right? Because this is an outdoor thing. It's huge. And it just demolishes everything in its path.
I think I just committed a war crime on accident.
That is what happened on January 15th, 1919. In what is referred to as the Great Molasses Flood.
Okay, so just for reference, I have no idea what Jim's going to talk about. This all is a surprise to me. You're hearing it live. So the nougat metaphor, there was actually a molasses reservoir?
There was a molasses reservoir, yes. So 2.3 million gallons of molasses was stored in Boston on the north end.
Of course it's in Boston. You said 1919?
In 1919, absolutely.
What were we doing in 1919 to need that much molasses?
Well, as I'm glad you asked. There's two answers. The first is we were just out of a world war, and molasses can be used. Molasses is actually a very important, at that time, was a very important component in ethanol production, right? So they're fermenting it to make alcohol.
Really?
And alcohol, yes. And alcohol was being used in munitions, in medical equipment, like obviously like to like sterilization. And then also, of course, alcohol for beverage consumption.
Get slammered, right?
To get slammered, absolutely. And this was right before Prohibition. So,
oh,
like,
no.
Yes. So people were loading up because Prohibition didn't go into effect for another year after they passed the bill, which was the 16th of January. So people were loading up, trying to stockpile and make as much alcohol as they could before it became illegal. And then also we had just gotten done with, you know, World War One, and so the munitions requirements for molasses were enormous. So there was this storage tank. It measured 90 feet in diameter. And
right,
50...
I'm trying to put that in perspective, right?
Yes.
A 90-foot diameter, that's like 30 yards.
Yep.
So that's a pretty good screen pass.
And 50 feet tall. So this is a five-story building that's almost like as big as like a football field, right? Because not nearly. No, it's like a third of a football field size, right? So this is an enormous tank, right? 2.3 million gallons of molasses stored in this holding tank.
Just for my, like, is molasses like a fluid or is it like a viscous liquid?
So it's very sticky, right? So at room temperature, molasses is like pretty slow. It's like a syrupy consistency. But keep in mind, it's January right now in Boston.
So it's cold.
1919. So it's cold.
It's real cold.
It's real cold. But molasses is a fluid. So when they move molasses from tank to tank, because it's brought in basically in like shipping, like almost like an oil tanker, right? They actually heat the molasses in order to be able to pump it, right?
Oh, so there's like an energy requirement for the movement of this, and they just store it kind of cold?
Yes.
So it
gets
in place?
They store it in this tank. And the thing is, when you put, when you warm up 2.3 million gallons of molasses, it takes an obscenely long time to cool down, right? So, like, over the past week, basically, the ships had been filling this tank with molasses, right? And so all that molasses is still pretty hot. So keep in mind, like, inside the tank, the molasses is actually quite fluid. But basically, the tank was full, and on the day where it broke, they're thinking that basically the old molasses, which at that point was cooled down, as it gets heated up, it expands, right? So everything's a spring. Remember, with temperature, things expand. So the molasses heats up, and
it's like me when I find like a bag of Cheez-Its.
Yes, absolutely, and so. Amazing. Yeah, so as the molasses all heats up in this tank, and like over the course of the day, right, you know, there's these day-night cycles where the tank is expanding.
Oh, so you're having cyclic heating as well.
You have this cyclic heating, you have these day-night heating cycles, and you have the heating cycles of molasses being added and removed from the tank, and you have
I don't
stress.
Like where this is going.
Yes, our favorite subject, fatigue failure, is coming into play. And so what happens is that the tank bursts. For whatever reason, the tank bursts. And 2.3 million gallons
that's hard
of molasses,
to, like, think
of
about.
Hot molasses spills out onto the streets of Boston.
Wait, time out. So you have, one, let's talk about the elephant in the room. We're storing what I assume is like a water tank, like what you would see driving down the highway, full of molasses, five feet tall. So five stories tall, 50 feet.
Yep.
Of what is assumedly a very viscous liquid. I'm just thinking about all the terrible, like, that's, you drown in oil. So how does this work?
Yeah. So the molasses tank bursts and it just dumps molasses, hot molasses at this point, into the cold streets of Boston. It's like 40 degrees that day.
Oh.
And like horses, like there's people, right? There's people everywhere, right? And the molasses just like goes, right? And witnesses.
It's like a tsunami of molasses?
It's a tsunami of molasses. And they say, like, they felt the ground rumble and the roar of the collapse of the tank. And then this thunderclap, right? Where the molasses, because molasses actually is denser than water. It weighs about 12 pounds a gallon, right? And it slams into, like, train cars and elevated, there's, like, an elevated rail track, like, rail car that gets slammed into and, like, almost goes over. And, like, it's moving at, like, 30, there's a wave of molasses moving at, like, 35 miles an hour through the streets of Boston. And it's picking up people and throwing them. It's picking up people and horses and stuff and trapping them in the molasses.
What the heck?
And then it gets cold, right? So then the molasses gets cold and it gets sticky and it gets like congealed. And now you like you're trapped in the molasses. It's really
so you have this like
it's terrifying.
What feels like world ending event for the folks on this street in Boston. You know, you're walking out of your house and, you know, yes. You talk like this because you're from Boston. And then, you know, the last thing you see as you're trying to get on your horse, you're like, oh, what a beautiful day. It's 40 degrees. I'm in Boston. And then it's a wall, a tsunami of molasses. And not only are you getting hit with all that pressure, I'm assuming.
Yep.
You couldn't escape if you wanted to. Like,
no.
It's going to send you down the street with some force.
Let me read you an excerpt from the Boston Post at the time. Molasses. Waist deep, covered the street and swirled and bubbled about the wreckage. Here and there struggled a form. Whether it was an animal or human being was impossible to tell. Only an upheaval, a thrashing about in the sticky mass, showed that any life was there. Horses died like so many flies on sticky flypaper. The more they struggled, the deeper in the mess they were ensnared. Human beings, men and women, suffered likewise.
That's terrible. So, like, just struggling is making it worse for yourself.
It is, yeah. And so some people got trapped, but other people got thrown. So it says, people were picked up by a rush of air and hurled many feet. Others had debris, like, thrown at them. Again, like, there's this train car that almost gets tipped over by the weight of the molasses that's hitting it.
Holy.
Like, 150 people got hurt. There were 21 people who got killed in this. So it's really this huge tragedy.
That's really sad. I'm genuinely surprised it wasn't more just based on the amount effect. That's,
I mean,
21 people dead, hundreds injured.
Yeah, 150 people injured and a bunch of like horses and animals really aren't counted here. But
I guess horses were king back then. Wild. Like there was no real like. There was cars, but there wasn't many, right?
This was like the early day of cars. And like, again, there's like an elevated rail system that's nearby that was damaged because of it. It's really quite a tragedy. And one of the effects of this was actually, you know, this was like one of the first class action lawsuits resulted from this. The victims of the families and people who were injured. They put together one of the first class action lawsuits and
wait, so who owned the tank? Like, was it a company? A Federal Reserve?
Yes. So the company is the United. Well, so sort of the company was Purity Distilling. That was the name of the company. But Purity Distilling had recently been purchased by the United States Industrial Alcohol Company. So this is kind of
the worst acquisition of all times. Can you imagine?
Yeah, really? Yeah, absolutely. But so it's really kind of an unfortunate purchase.
That's
for
so
the
sad.
USIA. But
wait, forget the company. You just covered the streets in molasses, which should be funny, but because of the like context, it's really not.
It's really terrible. No, it's this huge tragedy. And you know, the cleanup for this went on like for decades, right? Because
how do you clean up molasses? You need a solvent.
So it's salt water, actually. They use salt water. And basically like, but like you have, again, like 2.3 million gallons of molasses and the cleanup.
I can't even visualize that in my head. Like how much water
sticky,
is that?
It's so sticky. Right. And so the cleanup crews are tracking molasses all over the city, you know?
So it's like a super spreader event, you know, like you're trying to fix the problem, but you're bringing it into other places.
You're bringing it over the places like, you know, so floors, railings, door handles,
sewage,
the like, subways, like everywhere. Everywhere it's just sticky everywhere. And
can
then,
you
like,
imagine being a shop owner? Like, would you even try mopping?
You'd have to, right? You'd have to, but you'd have to mop like constantly. But yeah,
there's no point in taking your shoes off. It's you lose them. They're gone.
Oh no, they're gone. they're stuck in the molasses. Oh my gosh. But yeah, and so like it smelled apparently in Boston like molasses for like decades.
What does molasses decades. Smell like?
It's kind of chocolatey, I think.
Oh, that's nice. Does it? I guess big question: does it spoil, or is this like a shelf stable thing?
It's pretty stable because it's kind of like honey.
Okay. So it's not like rotting on the street. So that's one positive, right?
Yeah. So it's kind of like gingerbread, apparently.
Ooh. I feel like that would get old after the first week.
Oh yeah, I imagine. Well, I think you'd kind of get nose blind to it, right?
Yeah, that's
you
fair.
Eventually just kind of. It's just.
Kinda I mean, I'm assuming Boston smelled better than it does now, right?
I think so. I think the smell of molasses is preferable to the smell of Boston.
The smell of Industrial Revolution Boston.
Oh my God! Yeah, like 1919. There's still like sewage in the streets, and there's just like horse dung everywhere.
Everywhere.
Yeah.
Plus of after all was, the like initial carnage is just like wow, yeah, it's kind of a nice shirt.
You gotta look on the bright side. Absolutely. Smells like gingerbread cookies.
You're saying molasses are made of
nuts.
Yes. Oh my gosh. But yeah, so molasses gets everywhere. But one of the things that this tragedy does, is it kind of kicks off again, like one of the first class action lawsuits in America, and it creates this avenue for people to get justice. And it creates this avenue for corporate regulation. Because
they say regulation is like inked in blood. And I guess this is a great example of that. Like, how do you regulate a tank for something like this?
And so,
is it a pressurized tank?
No, just gravity, right? But when you have 50 feet high of molasses... So
I guess it pressurizes itself.
Absolutely. So if you actually look at the tank pressure, basically, it's a function of height of the fluid and then the specific gravity of that fluid. I don't know the specific gravity of molasses off the top of my head, but because
I don't think anyone does.
I'm sure we could look it up, but because it's heavier than water, so it's actually harder to hold back than water. Specific gravity is effectively it's a measurement of like weight per basic unit, but it's heavier than water, so the specific gravity is going to be a bit higher than water, and it's 50 feet high. I mean, you know, so
that's a lot of liquid.
It's huge.
Like the volume
right?
is ridiculous.
Yeah, I mean, you're looking at like. You're basically looking at creating a dam. You know, like there are dams that are less than 50 feet high.
Dang, I didn't even think about that. Like a five-story dam. Like if you look at, we live in like, you know, the South, right? So we're used to what, the Tennessee Valley Authority dams mostly?
Which are enormous. I mean, those are huge. Hundreds of feet tall. But even at like, you know, small dams for like windmills, grist mills, these things can easily be, you know, 20 feet tall. So you're talking about a structure that has to hold well more than double that in terms of pressure at the base if it's full, right? This obviously if it's full.
Right, and it's like the, I guess for all of our non-physics folks, including me, so like you have the pressure of the thing, like the molasses itself is pushing down on itself and that in turn is pushing out on the container. How wide does a container for this purpose, how much depth does it have? Is it like a foot wide wall? Is
like how more? Thick?
Yeah, how thick? With
well,
two
it's going it's going to depend a little bit on. It's going to depend on a few things. So it's going to depend on what material the tank is made out of, and then it's also going to depend on. That's basically what
it's just the material.
On. It's what is the material, and I mean to a certain extent, like how are you joining that material together? Because in this instance, you know, this was really before welding was prevalent.
Like a barrel where it's like strapped together with metal on the
You could do that. So this was actually a steel tank. And so there's been some, there's actually in 2014, there was some modern engineering analysis that was done on this.
Cool.
And they found the steel was only half as thick as it should have been. Even with the lower standards of the time that they had,
Oh, so
and
this
so
is like
with
hindsight of like being able to model this.
Absolutely. And the steel was actually made of a subpar material as well. So it was extra brittle.
Did they get it from Boeing?
They did it for, they did not choose their material very well. So this was done on the cheap, right? Like, this was a cost saving effort because, I mean,
I bet you're thinking, oh, I'm making a tank for molasses. How hard could it be?
Yeah, but then the tank's 90 feet in diameter and 50 feet tall. I mean, it's this huge structure. So it was made too thin, and it was made out of subpar material. And and the rivets, apparently, because all these tanks at this point in time are riveted together, because welding doesn't really exist yet.
So the rivets themselves are like giving structural destabilization too, right?
Correct. So there's in engineering, there's these things called stress risers or stress concentrations. And that's basically where if you have like a hole or a crack in a piece of material, the stress will concentrate at that point, and it will tend to cause additional fatigue loading and stress to accentuate that failure, and it will create a kind of a cascading effect of potentially, and in this case, rapid and catastrophic failure, where the material just basically rips apart, like a zipper almost, because the stress is built up.
So I think we were going to see this as, you know, if we keep doing engineering episodes, this is one of those common themes in at least the failure episodes, right?
Yes. So generally in a lot of these engineering failures, you see two or three different very repeated patterns, which is really is tragic, frankly. You see fatigue loading. So cyclic loading causes fatigue in the material. And what that means is that initially the material might be able to hold a certain amount of weight or stress. But as you unload and load it, what happens is the material develops kind of a memory of the stress if it's not designed appropriately. And over time, the material will actually degrade and it will no longer be able to hold that stress. And so over time, it will cause this creeping failure where you're getting closer and closer to the failure point without really knowing it. Because unless you're very diligent about your maintenance and you're very diligent about your inspections, a lot of times these fatigue failures will go unnoticed. And a lot of times when you have the circumstances that lead to fatigue failure, such as cost-cutting measures or lack of design expertise.
When you're cutting corners, pretty much.
When you're cutting corners.
It's avoidable, or is what you're saying.
It's absolutely avoidable, especially with modern materials and modern simulation abilities and modern understanding of all of these joints. Fatigue failure is something that is very, very avoidable, or at the very least, you can be on the lookout for it, and you should be, right? Because part of engineering is you have to make all these assumptions about the problem that you're trying to wrap your head around, or the
assume
design.
A spherical molasses.
yes. But anyway, that we're getting a little bit off track. But yeah, so these fatigue stresses and fatigue failure is one of these very common, very prevalent modes of engineering failure that often leads to catastrophe, especially with these very big projects, like these huge tanks or bridges are another.
Multiple cycles of cars and trucks going over it.
Absolutely.
So if I could dumb this down, if I have like a simple thing, like a balloon, right? And I blow it up and let it loose. It's going to be a lot easier in this example to blow up after the third time because the materials fatiguing over time?
Yes,
so would
absolutely.
That be an example?
That's a great example of fatigue failure. Well, not a failure in this case, but fatigue stress or fatigue of the material becoming deformed, right? So this actually goes into what's called plastic deformation, which is where you have fatigue failure symptoms beginning to show up. And a balloon is an interesting example because it's made out of an elastomer, right? They're usually made out of rubber, which has a much greater degree of expansion than most engineering materials. Most engineering materials like steel or aluminum.
You don't want it expanded.
So the deformation is usually very small, right? Like the amount of deformation that's acceptable in these structures is very, very small. Depending on the structure, it can be, you know, as big as a few inches over the entire structure, or as small as, you know, a few thousandths of an inch, right? I mean, so it just depends on the application. But elastomers, like rubbers and balloons and stuff like this, they are very good at they deform an enormous amount, right? But right, the concept, like, is still there.
Does that, like, give the pressure, I don't know the best way to say this, but it, like, decentralizes that pressure over the entire structure instead of just one area?
Kind of. It depends on your application. In the case of, like, the balloon, you might say, like, it's going to take less effort to fill the volume, right? So when you initially blow up the balloon, because the rubber is still fairly tight, you might actually have to put in more pressure in order to get the volume of the balloon that you want. But then if you deflate it and then you blow into it again, it's easier to blow up. You're putting less pressure into the system to get that volume back into the balloon. That's because the material has stretched and plastically deformed. So it will never go back to the way it was. So in engineering, a lot of times what we use is called Young's modulus. And so there's a stress strain curve. There's a stress strain graph that's very common in engineering.
And I've seen that for, like, my airplane disasters I look up.
Absolutely, right? So basically what it does is it creates this straight line where the correlation between the stress that's applied to a material and the deformation of that material is linear, or roughly linear, right?
Right.
And that, for most engineering materials, is what is called the elastic zone. And so if you stress a material to that, anywhere in that elastic zone, it's going to return back to its initial condition, right? So if you stretch the piece of steel, you know, you put, I don't know, you know, 40,000 PSI on it or whatever, it'll stretch a little bit, but then if you release that pressure, it will return to its original form. Once you get above Young's modulus, so for steel, I believe it's, let me make sure I'm not making a fool out of myself, but it's usually, I think it's like 70 gigapascals. Young's modulus.
Gigapascals. The units that engineers have to use, I guess for it's just the scale of things, right? Like in biology, I'm thinking of like things in, you know, atmospheres, pascals. To think about a gigapascal is something else.
It is. So the Young's modulus of steel for this application is 27,500 KSI, which is 1,000 pounds per square inch. So basically, it's like 27 million PSI, right?
That's ridiculous.
Is Young's modulus, right?
Unimaginable amount of pressure in day-to-day
life. So steel is extremely strong, right? But keep in mind, that's per square inch, right? So you can actually have, for example, like if you have a quarter inch bolt, right? A quarter inch bolt, like what's the area of that bolt? I mean, it's very small. I mean, it's, the cross-sectional area of that bolt is very small. So you can have, you know, a few thousand pounds shear that bolt or tear that bolt in half because it's a measure of square area. Right.
So this is why we always buy our galvanized bolts.
Yeah, go for your grade eight bolts. But and they have a strong, and that's why grade eight bolts are stronger, is because they have a higher Young's modulus. They have a higher a modulus of elasticity, is what it's also known as, right? But anyway, so the basic idea is the higher your Young's modulus, the higher your modulus of elasticity, the more stress you can put on a material, the more you can apply load to it before it will plastically deform. And the plastic deformation is where you really start to run into issues. And the plastic deformation is basically means that you're loading the material past the point that it will safely hold that over multiple iterations.
So now, it might be able to hold it once, but it's when you get into that like cyclic loading where you have, you know, you're opening up yourself for failure.
Yes. And this is oversimplifying it. There are additional methods that you have to keep into account where, you know, basically you're looking at like the number of cycles you're expecting this piece of equipment to experience or whatever. And there's different levels, right? So if you want something to last literally forever, you actually can't even go all the way up to the elastic limit of the material, right? But if you only need something to survive for, you know, let's say 100,000 cycles, you might be able to go pretty close to the elastic limit of the material, but you have to keep that in mind with your design, right?
So this is where we get back to the regulatory issue, like when companies try to, you know, extend the life or the engineers tell you to use the tank for versus, you know, I'm going to use it for an extra year until the new one comes. And, you know, you just open yourself up for a huge, and think about it. This is the story you just talked about is 1919, you said?
Yes.
Yes, so you don't have any CT scans, you know, you're not able to get you're not getting any data besides visual inspection and whatever like resonance testing they can do back then, right?
Absolutely. And one of the notes of this that's in here is basically like people heard the tank like groaning, right? Like
oh, so they had warning signs?
Yeah, like the tank was like audibly groaning under the stress.
I think it's hungry. Thing.
Exactly.
It wants more molasses.
It wanted to eat all the people around it.
It did.
And it did. So it's just this crazy, it's just this crazy thing. And in fairness to like the people who maybe designed that tank, like fatigue stress and fatigue failure like modes were not well understood at that time. And really would not be well understood until decades later. But even then, like, you know, they cut corners. They like the steel was subpar. The steel was only half as thick as it should have been, even with the standards of the time. I mean, it really is kind of unexcusable. And that's why there was this class action lawsuit. And these people were given, you know, basically in today's money, it's about $120,000. $120,000 per person.
That could buy you like 80 houses back then.
Yeah, per victim, right? I mean, and that's huge, right? So, it's kind of wild, you know?
And it's interesting how it like kind of paves the path because you got to think about where this is in history, right? You're talking, like you said, post-World War I, pre-World War II, right? You know, in that sweet spot before Prohibition, there's about to be a lot of tanks made. Like, you got to think about this contextually across the country, right? Like, a lot of folks are going to start making stills and stuff. So it's interesting. The timing of it's really interesting, right? Because, like, this wouldn't happen in Georgia. Like, if you put the same tank... Because the heat wouldn't cycle as much, it's a completely different problem.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, and because of the hot cold cycles the steel being more brittle in the cold, there's all kinds of different factors that could have contributed to the failure. And to me, that's like one of the really fascinating parts about analyzing these types of events is why did it fail? What can we point to? So one of the things is like there's a fatigue crack potentially at like one of the manhole covers to get in and out of the tank near the base of the tank.
Oh, so this is a tank people are climbing into when it's empty?
I mean, yeah. I mean, you have to get in there to maintain it, right? Because it's 50 feet tall and 90 feet diameter. I mean, it's huge.
Think about how much of a pain that is to, even if you were the guy to say, all right, we got to drain the tank into tank two so we can take a look inside. It's covered in molasses. Like
it's all covered in molasses. Yeah. And part of this too is like, how do you build something like this? Right. And especially at this point in time when there's no welding, like you have it's got to be riveted together and rivets, you have to drive from both sides of the joint.
It's so a lot of people smacking it with a hammer.
Yeah. From both sides. Right. So basically you have a guy on the inside of the tank with a block, you know, holding that against the rivet, and then the guy on the outside of the tank hitting the other side of the rivet with a sledgehammer to drive the material together to hold the plates together.
I didn't think about how rivets back in the day. This is manpower. Like you're not.
This is manpower.
There's no pneumatic press. There's no.
There's steam driven tools, right? So a lot of these tools might be steam driven. They'd have like a steam engine nearby that's basically powering these tools, But yeah, I mean, it's literally there's a guy on the inside of the tank and there's a guy on the outside of the tank and they're smacking this rod of steel to drive these two plates together. That's how they're building this, right?
You know, you don't want to be the guy on the inside. You think they have to like, draw straws?
God.
Give me the outside guy with the sledgehammer all day.
Like the noise. Can you imagine like
the reverberation? Oh,
in
my
a
gosh.
50-foot tall steel chamber. Like, oh my
goodness.
And
today we're going to learn how tinnitus is a spring.
Yes.
Holy.
And so then like, also just like the noise, right? Like just the hearing damage that these guys could have.
Because I'm guessing they're not. This is the 20s. Well, 1919 going into the 20s. We're not wearing ear protection.
Oh, no. We died like men.
It's not nearly manly enough to wear your ears and eyes.
Absolutely not. We died like men.
Yeah, dumb.
None of this sissy shit we got to deal with today. We died like men. I bet you, like, when they were doing the rivets at the top of the tank, like, they weren't even strapped in. They were just, standing on a scaffold. They're just standing on a scaffolding, just slinging a sledgehammer around on 50 feet up in the air.
Yeah, you see the pictures of, like, construction, like, some people, like, I guess this was more in the 40s, but, you know, they were just, like, wrapping their legs around I-beams, hoping for the best, eating lunch, having a bite.
Yeah, they're just up there, you know, the pictures of, like, the Empire State Building or whatever, you know, being built around the same time. Where, yeah, they're just guys, you know, hanging their legs off the edge of the fucking world, you know, eating lunch.
You know, things I don't want to do.
Absolutely insane. But this crazy thing, and all because, you know, the company...
cut some corners.
You know, they were cutting corners. They were trying to save a few bucks on this enormous tank, and they didn't take into account the cyclical loading and fatigue failure at the rivets, right? So this is another interesting thing, right? You can actually have the material able to take the stress, right? So it's not like the steel plates just ruptured. Right. It's actually the joints of the steel plates, or in this case, apparently the manhole cover, that creates the stress risers that lead to the failure, right? So that creates the stress riser where the joint itself actually rips apart. And that causes, at that point, right? Because if you have a cylinder, right? It's basically a circle, right? And so the stress path is going all the way around that circle. So it's very, very strong because the steel is being loaded in tension all the way around. The steel is being pulled apart. The steel is very, very strong in tension. But at the rivets, at the manhole covers, you have the rivets and you have the joints that are now in shear. And eventually you have it just rip the rivets apart, and then you're no longer in stress. The steel is no longer being loaded in tension. It's now being loaded in bending, right? So it's just being bent out of the way, like literally bent in half to allow this flood of 2.3 million gallons of molasses, of hot molasses, to pour out onto
the streets of Boston.
Just into the streets of Boston.
And it's like, it comes out with some force, too. We're talking about that much liquid, and it's thick liquid, too.
35 miles an hour.
I don't know much about flow rate, but like, there's a lot of potential energy waiting, you know?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of pressure being put on that, which is crazy.
Jim, I think when we get to the end of a story like this, right, we got to ask ourselves, you know, what do we learn? Like, what do we learn? How do we avoid becoming... covered in molasses, so to speak, in the streets of Boston.
In the streets of Boston, you know, it's a difficult
Step
thing
one,
to...
don't go to Boston.
I was going to say, it's a hard thing to go to Boston and not come away sticky, right?
Oh, gosh. What are you doing in Boston?
I've never been to Boston. It looks like a lovely
Boston
town.
Looks beautiful. Like, it's
I would love to go.
Beautiful looking place. That's all I'll say about it.
I've never been... Have you been to Boston?
I have been to Boston. Like, I like the way Boston looks. As a black guy, I don't really love Boston. A lot of racist in Boston. Not everyone, but, you know, it's unfortunate. I don't know if that's a new thing that's happened in recent history, but a lot of the angry racists are in Boston right now. I don't know why.
That's not good. Yeah, I don't know. Maybe we need to build more molasses tanks in Boston to subpar standards.
I think we need to build some education all around this country. Like, we can talk about engineering disasters because that's pretty linear in my head, right? Like, that is something failed, right?
Right.
But when we start talking about people and the societal failures around that, I don't know if that's a spring. It's several springs, probably.
Yeah, that's a very complicated system for sure.
No, but all love to my friends in Boston because, you know, it is a beautiful place. If you ever been to Boston Harbor, like, it's, I could see why folks would just love to live there. I don't personally love the cold.
Yeah, I'm a southern boy myself, you know, so the
I'm
cold
used
is
to
tough.
Warm. We're at fall, but it's still like 80.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. It's been beautiful weather, but down here, but anyway, I digress. But yeah, like what can we take away from this? You know, and I think there's a lot of things that we can take away from this. First, you know, is of course, you know, this tragedy led to kind of the first class action lawsuits in America. It led to corporate regulation. And one of the things in my mind, which is good in my opinion, because here's the thing, right? Like corporations exist to create profit. They do not exist to protect the public good. Exactly, right? Like, and that's the thing. And I think that's something, at least to me, like we have to look at is as a society, we should not trust corporate entities to look out for the safety of the public. That is the government's role. And so having this takeaway basically be, look, the left to their own devices, corporations should not be trusted. And that's where the government needs to step in and say, look, here are the standards. If you're going to build a molasses tank, like you have to take into account the fatigue loading, the cyclic loading, the heat cycles that's going to be going in and out of this. And it has to be inspected by somebody to make sure regularly. That you are crossing all of your I's and dotting all of your T's.
Got to cross your I's.
You got to cross your I's, especially if you're going to be in government.
When you're looking at a tank that big, you have to cross your I's.
And you got to dot your T's. You got to dot your T's.
see, that leads us to the Boston Harbor, where they dotted their T's.
Indeed. And it's worth noting that the Boston Harbor was color of molasses until the next summer.
Was it really?
Because there was so much molasses in the water.
Doesn't that sound like a terrible cologne? Color of molasses coming soon to a Macy's near you.
Oh, no. Oh, Jesus. It's terrible. Oh,
I feel like I learned something today. Like, and it's like core concepts that are clearly like we started in 1919. I'm sure we're going to jump around in history, but kind of seeing how we humans really don't learn our lessons. We just kind of scale up the complexity and forget the basics over time.
It is. And oh my gosh, I've been reading Walden by Henry David Thoreau recently.
Classic.
It's a great book. The guy is absolutely hilarious. It was a recommended.
He's an angry man.
He was I mean, but his wit is just absolutely razor sharp, and a lot of the insights in the book are placed in a very funny way. But it really is. It's very funny, but it's also like, wow, humans have not changed very much in the last 300 years.
No, we haven't. Like whether you're looking at the Roman Empire or the American Empire now, we're going to see some of the same themes of failure. Because why would you learn from history?
Exactly. And to me, like that just comes back to this idea of like the institutional constraints that we've put in place, these regulations, these regulatory bodies, they're there because human nature doesn't change. But we can build systems that will help us. And that's what it is, right? So like when you talk, in my opinion of like kind of the neoliberal age that we find ourselves in, where we've had this really big drive to deregulate industry.
Oh, yeah. In my opinion, lot after 2020. Like you saw a huge uptick.
Yeah, I mean, it's really been since the Reagan administration where you have this really big deregulation era. And I think really we're seeing a lot of the dangers of that coming back to play. Where
it really is an attitude change in like, because like you said, it's not the company's responsibility to regulate the system; it's the government's, right? And you're seeing these folks go into government without much knowledge over the things that they're overseeing, like these oversight committees we hear so much about. Not many engineers on it, you know, all things considered.
That's true. Right. And that's the difficulty of it, right, too? Because think about it this way, right? The corporation's job is to make money. And at a certain point, one of the best ways to make money is to deregulate the system. And so how do you deregulate the system? Well, you pay off all these Congress people and you make sure that that your guys are on the kind of the advisory committees that talk to congressmen about how do we regulate these industries. You know, so that's you got to cool be very, you very don't. Careful. You don't. What if you just didn't? You know, and then the companies can make more money. And you know, there's a certain aspect where we don't see this as much in civil engineering and kind of these older professions where there's a little bit more.
Like the bridges like have already fallen enough for them to learn.
Yes, right. Like so, like there, and it's physical, right? Like the physical danger stuff is a little bit harder to deregulate because it's just like, okay, well, we've done this before.
Right. We see why we need grades for roads and bridges because we've seen what happens when we don't, and we might talk about a couple more of those in the future.
Oh, and we will absolutely. There's a lot of amazing engineering failures when it comes to bridges, and other civil engineering structures.
Oh, bridges, you know what? Great. I was just thinking, you know, we know a lot of engineers after this is the pilot. So, you know, we're kind of just feeling things out this episode. But, I think we're getting close to time, Jim. So I wanted to make sure we left some time to you should plug your company. You really should plug your business.
Well, thanks, Derek. I appreciate that. Yeah. So I am the founder and co-owner of The Whiskey Grail. We are a white oak drinking vessel that is made to mimic a bourbon barrel. And it really does enhance the flavor and the experience of drinking whiskey and rums. Anything that's aged in a white oak barrel really is going to benefit from this drinking vessel. So that's what we do. We change the way that you experience whiskey. So check us out, www.whiskeygrail.com, or find us on social media at The Whiskey Grail on all the platforms. Check us out. Pick up a cup. We've got some great content over on our social media if you are interested to take a look at that. So yeah, thanks, Derek. Thanks for getting me to plug. Shameless plug.
I love The Whiskey Grill, but you know, I'm of course inherently biased. I was there, not there, but I remember when you made the company and to see how much you've grown and how like you have employees now, you know, like
that's wild. Crazy. Oh my gosh, it's crazy. Yeah,
it's a great product. Like, I love whiskey. It's my favorite alcohol to drink if I'm going to drink something. And I'm nothing hits harder than picking up your whiskey grill, getting your little big old ice cube into it, sitting on your porch on a hot Georgia summer day, and just sipping the afternoon away in your whiskey grill. I'm telling you what, it's a good taste.
Thanks,
well, I guess we need to plug ourselves too, right? So this has been the first episode of Everything's a Spring, a podcast currently about engineering, but you know, we'll kind of jump outside the box a bit. Once again, my name's Derek.
And I'm Jim.
And you can find us on, I actually made us some social media. I know we don't personally like social media, but I figured it'd be nice to get some feedback, you know, what they liked. And if you have any suggestions for future content you want to hear about, you want to see us write something up on a certain engineering disaster or success that you've heard about, go ahead and meet us on Twitter. I'm not going to call it X. You can't make me. At All R Spring. That's A-L-L-A-R-E. Spring, S-P-R-I-N-G. That's at All Our Spring. We have a Twitter, Jim. How does it feel?
I feel enlightened.
Enlightened's a word.
I feel like I have become the media entrepreneur, the media entity that I was always born to be.
I mean, always knew it would end at Twitter, right? Like...
What a dumpster fire. Like, honestly.
Oh my gosh. Can we do an episode about Twitter? Holy. Just the history of Twitter's an engineering disaster.
We should probably get
engineering disaster.
Oh my gosh. We should probably get like a marketing person on to talk about Twitter.
Can you imagine?
Because I'm not a marketing guy, but like, can you imagine having Twitter, right? Like a brand that is so recognizable.
Yeah.
And then you decide, you know what?
Throw it away.
I don't want it anymore. Let's call it X.
I could do an entire episode on Elon's stupidity, but
oh
like,
my God.
This is a recurring theme in his life. He loves naming things X, but to avoid talking about him for now, we should probably sign off. Once again, thank you so much for joining us and
let's bounce.
Oh, I love it. Let's bounce.
Let's bounce.